friends, we had a bit of a technical glitch a couple weeks ago, so this is a re-recording of our first teaching on happiness and disappointment in life. And we've been moving through Exodus, so our brief stop in Exodus comes to an end this morning. We're heading into this recurring series that I'm calling The Archaeology of the Ordinary. It's a ongoing series that will try to uncover the spiritual significance of the most ordinary things in life. Could be an object, a thing, just something that's so common we often look past it. And I want to start this morning by examining some of the most ordinary human experiences there are: our desire to be happy and our frequent failure to find it. And what got me thinking about this as I was reflecting on the Hebrew people's wilderness journey after they had left Egypt. And so you'll remember the past few weeks we covered some of the early parts of the Exodus story. And what happens is after that, Moses goes to Egypt. There's a lot of big Hollywood scenes, some special effects in play. But after some big drama in Egypt, the Hebrew people, they escape slavery. They leave the chains of Egyptian bondage. They head out on their own into the wilderness. They are now free. But that was only ever one part of God's story. God's plan was not just about delivering these people from slavery. It was about bringing them back to the promised land, the land of their ancestors. And the promised land described by God is not just a piece of real estate. It's like the deeper meaning of the land in the story is more significant than that. It's like described as this land flowing with milk and honey. It's pictured as a sort of heaven on earth, a paradise, a place of peace and prosperity. It's seen, I think you could say, as a place where the people could be happy. The promised land is pictured as the promise of happiness for a people. And yet for these former Hebrew slaves, the promised land can never be found. They spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness. They're skirting around it, never able to enter it, find it. And the promise of happiness, you could say, for them is a place these people are never quite able to find. I don't know about you, but I think part of the meaning of that story, them wandering in the wilderness, is to remind us of that. How often happiness feels as if it's always just over the horizon or out of reach or never fully attainable. And the record of the Hebrew people wandering in the desert, it just reminds us of this frequently. The journey towards the promised land ends up for them marked by difficulties and disappointments and complaints and hardships. And of course, their story is our story. Their experience is our experience. I want you to notice, I want to read a few passages from the book of Numbers, which is where we pick up a lot of this wilderness story. I want to notice in these passages how often their complaints, their hardships, tend to focus around how they're confused about what they want, how they end up wanting the wrong things, or there's a lot of short-term thinking going on. It starts in Numbers 11. It tells us the people complained about their hardships. And then later on, we pick up in Numbers 11, it says the rabble, I love that as a catch-all phrase, the rabble with them began to crave other food. They had been only getting manna at this point. And the Israelites started wailing and they said, if only we had meat to eat. Don't you remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost? And there was cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. But now we've lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. So interesting to me. They're free now, but now that they're free, they start wondering, what do we really want? Because back in Egypt, life was a little bit easier. And so we see here they want the wrong thing. They're thinking short-sightedly here. The story picks up, God gives them quail, provides them a little bit of meat. But then in Numbers 14, it says this, that night, all the members of the community, they raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole assembly said to them, if only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to each other, you know what? We should choose a leader and just go back to Egypt. Again, short-term thinking. They're dealing with some short-term hardships. And their first impulse is, well, what do we want? Maybe we should go back. We've got no security here. At least we did in Egypt. They feel vulnerable. And the reality is, if you track the story, God continually, consistently provides for them. And yet, when faced with hardships, their first impulse is short-term thinking, confusion about what they want, wanting the wrong things. More grumbling in number 16, they grumbled against Moses and Aaron. In Numbers 20, it says this, there was no water for the community. And the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, again, if only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring us out into this wilderness that we should die? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It's got no grain or figs or grapevines or pomegranates. There's no water to drink. I'm very interested in the certain foods that they find themselves craving, from pomegranates to leeks and onions and grapevines. It's interesting to me. But again, faced with hardships, they end up only being able to see that. And the reality is, God has always provided for them, but they find themselves without and end up wishing to return to Egypt. And you know, I think the structure of their journey is very telling. The promised land of happiness always feels over the horizon, out of reach, never fully attainable. And their story is our story, their experience, our experience. And you know, the Exodus story, it's not just some historical event. To me, it's the story of the human condition. And in that, it is the most ordinary experience in the world, searching for happiness, but never quite able to find it. Why is that so often our experience, our story as humans? Well, what I want to do over the next couple of weeks is start with some psychological explanations as to why this is, before trying to bring some sort of theological reflections for why happiness feels so elusive. And so I want to look at this psychologically for a bit this week, three reasons this week to the following week. And my hope is to find some wisdom in all of this for us. So first question, why is it so hard to find happiness in life? Well, because we don't know what we want. You know, one of the first things you notice in this story is the story begins in earnest with the Hebrew people crying out, God, save us, liberate us, we want out of slavery. But their wilderness journey is marked by something very different. Their expectations are shattered. Suddenly, freed from Egypt, they find themselves in hardship and they want to go back. They initially wanted freedom from Egypt, but now they're thinking maybe that was a mistake. And one of the key lessons in this story that rings true, I think, for us is this. People so often don't know what they want. And what we want can change rather quickly. It's the same with us. You know, if you were to sort of sit down and consider, how might I be happy in life? I mean, a reasonable place to begin would be with some self-assessment, some reflection. We might think to ourselves, what do I want? What will make me happy? And I think the problem is this. We don't know. We don't know how to answer that question. You know, I have a good friend who's constantly encouraging me, telling me, you know what, Brad, in your prayer life, you need to be very honest with God, very vividly express to God what you want in life. And sort of the point of encouraging me this way is to help me try to understand what are my desires and have me express those clearly to God. And you know what? It's really good advice, actually, because in the Gospel of John, these are actually Jesus' first words. Jesus' very first question in the Gospel of John is aimed at all of us. And his first words, his first question in that book are simply this: what do you want? Here's the thing, though. You know, I've gone through this exercise a number of times now. The problem is, I really don't No. What do you want in life? I don't know. If you remember from last season, we did a series on this thing called mimetic desire theory. And what mimetic desire posits is that figuring out what we want in life is almost impossible because we constantly borrow our desires and wants from other people. And that makes it really hard to know what we actually want. I have a friend who's an aspiring author and has just about gone through the entire process. And of course, you know, when you see somebody go through something like that, you start thinking to yourself, that sounds good. I wouldn't mind the idea of writing some things, publishing some things. And I was with him not too long ago. I said, well, you know, what does it really take to write and publish a book? And, you know, perhaps to state the obvious, his first response was, well, you have to write something. That would be the very first step. You have to establish a discipline every day. You've got to do some writing. You've got to make it a discipline. I said, okay, what's next? And he said, well, then you need to gain an online following. Most publishers, they won't even look at what you've done unless you have a following of between 5,000 and 10,000 people. And I'm thinking, what? That's crazy. How in the world would you ever achieve that or get that? And his response is, well, you have to be okay with shameless self-promotion. And then you gotta get an agent. And then you gotta pitch your book over and over again and face rejection over and over again. And by the time he's done describing the process to me, I'm thinking, I don't know. Do I want that? I think I do, but I'm not quite sure. Or the one show that Kristen and I can agree on, there's not too many that we both enjoy, but one of those is a show, it's off the air now, but it was called Departures, and these two friends, Scott and Justin, they just left everything behind and traveled the world, and every episode is them traveling to a new place. And so for like 4 or 5 seasons, they just spent years traveling the world in all of these different exotic locations, having what seemed to be the time of their lives, learning so many things, experiencing things most of us never will. And watching that show, I sit there thinking, oh, I want that so much. That looks like the ideal life. And yet when you start to think about it, I mean, I don't know about you, have you ever traveled with a friend for more than a few days or a week? I mean, it starts to get annoying. Traveling with people isn't easy. And then there's the whole airport thing. I mean, that's a nightmare. Sometimes we want things. We don't really know what we're looking for. We don't know if we really want that. And I think what so often happens is this. We don't know what we want, or we think we know what we want. But in reality, what happens is we fall in love with the idea of something rather than the actual thing itself. So we can fall in love with the idea of writing, the idea of traveling, but that's very different than what the actual thing itself looks like. I don't know about you, but this happens to me all the time with people. I have these, and this, hopefully this doesn't get too weird. I hope I'm not the only one who experiences this sort of thing, but I have these like platonic friendship crushes on strangers. It's a bizarre thing, but there are people that I encounter in life, and I kind of fall in love with the idea of them. I'll let you know what I mean. There's this guy at Value Mart. I've shopped there for 6 years, done, you know, at least some of my groceries there. And Mike, the Value Mart cashier guy, is just, I think he's just an astounding guy. Every time I check out, he's always there. He's very, very good at checking out. No, it doesn't take him long to check everything out. He's always encouraging. He's making funny little jokes. I always think to myself, I think he and I would make good friends. I asked Kristen one time, I said, would it be weird for me to ask Mike, the cashier guy at Value Mart, out for coffee? And she's like, yeah, I think that would be weird. There's a line there, which is too bad. I think he and I would really hit it off. But I have this impression of who this guy is in my head. Or there's this woman at the library, Ingrid the librarian, and she was the one person responsible for recommending to me the author Hampton Sides, who I absolutely love, one of my favorite authors. She recommended that author to me. She also recommended to me the book Stranger in the Woods, which might be one of my favorite books of the past year. And so I'm sort of, I'm in love with this idea that she just has this vast knowledge of books and would be just so fun to have coffee with, talk books. And I don't know about you, but this sort of thing happens to me all the time. I kind of fall in love with the idea of people. And, you know, I think this was the Hebrews people problem. They loved the idea of being free from Egypt, but actually being free, not so much. And it's the same with us. I love the idea of traveling. Actually traveling, not so much. I love the idea of being an author. The actual thing, not so much. I love the idea I conjure up in my head of people, but actual people, not so much. And it's the same with, if you missed it, Glenn had this just absolutely extraordinary, brilliant piece this morning. We love the idea of sitting down with people, being hospitable, but the actual sitting down with people, the kind of people who chew with their mouths open and talk too much, well, not so much of that. And you see, why is happiness so elusive for most of us? Because we don't really know what we want. We love the idea of things. And this was the experience of the Hebrew people. We want to be free, but now that we are, we're confused. We're not sure what we want anymore. Maybe Egypt was better. You know, our minds are complicated, mysterious, confusing, at times downright deceptive. And because of that, happiness is elusive because we don't know what we want. We get stuck. But here's the thing. Let's say you actually do know what you want, quite clearly, actually. You've done the work. You found some clarity around what you want in life. This is it. This is what I want. Well, the problem is this. We encounter a second problem. Why is it so hard to find happiness? Well, because even if we do know what we want, we often want the wrong things. And this is what Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert calls effective forecasting errors. And by the way, if you are interested in this, his book Stumbling on Happiness, or at least his TED Talk on happiness, is so good. It's really fascinating. It's worth checking out. But what he means by effective forecasting errors is that when we make decisions in life, what we're doing is we're trying to forecast the future, trying to forecast what decision will make us happy. But what Daniel Gilbert has found in his research is that humans are really bad at effective forecasting. We often make choices in life based on what we think might make us happy, but so often they don't. Why? Well, again, we don't understand how our minds work. And he's done, you know, some extraordinary research to back this up. I mean, consider this a little thought experiment. Let's say you're looking to buy a shirt, and there are two different stores that have a shirt that you kind of want. They're basically the same price. However, store A has a policy that will allow you to return and exchange the shirt for another if you get home and you realize you don't like it. But at store B, all sales are final. If you make the purchase, you're done. No refunds, no exchanges. Now, where do you buy the shirt from? Now, in his research, he has found that humans overwhelmingly buy from the store with the return policy. And why? Because we forecast, you know what, we might make a mistake, so it's better to buy in a way that allows us to keep our options open. Gilbert says, in effective forecasting, humans prefer situations that have changeable outcomes. And yet the problem is, changeable outcomes are so often a curse rather than a blessing. We think a changeable outcome is a better path to happiness, but it isn't. And what Gilbert has found is that changeability leaves us obsessively distracted, dissatisfied. You get home, do I really like this shirt? Does it fit well? I'm not sure. There was that blue shirt. Maybe that should have been the one that I bought. And we struggle with indecision. Whereas if we just make the final decision, we adapt. And our penchant for changeable situations and outcomes leaves us perpetually dissatisfied. It makes happiness elusive. And what Gilbert argues is that the tragedy in all of this is that we don't know how our brains work. And we don't know that what happens is we actually in our minds come equipped with what he calls a psychological immune system. And what that is a protective psychological mechanism that helps reconcile us to our life circumstances. But Gilbert says this, there's a trick with this immune system. It only works in dealing with situations where there is no changeable outcome. How it works is this, if you know a sale is final, even if you don't end up liking your shirt, you adjust and go about enjoying life. And there's still the possibility that you can be well suited to that. But the possibility of a changeable outcome, it doesn't kick in. And we're tormented by second guessing. Daniel Gilbert says this, our psychological immune system works best when we're totally stuck, when we're trapped. I find that fascinating. Why is happiness so elusive? We tend to think things like keeping our options open will make us happier, but it actually doesn't. It actually leaves us restless, frustrated, disappointed. And so by committing to not committing, we actually become less happy. And we see this in the Hebrew people wandering in the wilderness, don't we? They keep having their options open. Hey, worst case scenario, we could always go back to Egypt. Life would be better there. And what Gilbert says is that it's precisely them doing this, leaving open the option to go back to Egypt, that makes them so miserable in the first place. Our psychological immune system works only when we're stuck, without options. And when we're in that situation, it kicks in and allows us to enjoy life regardless of our situation. I mean, consider the difference between dating and marriage. I gotta tell you, I'm kind of done setting up friends on dates. Kristen and I have a friend who often comes over and she's looking for a relationship and is often struggling to find a meaningful relationship. And so we decided to set her up with someone we thought was great. And they went out on a date. And I remember after the date, we met with her. She's like, how did it go? And she's like, I don't know. I don't know. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? This is a great guy. He's got a great job. Attractive. This is good stuff. He's like, I don't know. I'm not sure I'll be happy with him. I'm like, what do you mean by that? I was like, well, he still lives with his parents. He was nervous. He was a bit sweaty at the dates. I'm like, come on. Those are so many petty things. She's like, you know, I just don't want to settle. And I was like, well, wait a second. I thought that's exactly what marriage is. Marriage is settling. That's like the definition of marriage. And you see, this is to me why dating and marriage are so interesting and different. This is what the psychological immune system does in action. When you're in dating mode, your options are open. You're in changeable outcome mode. And in that mode, the littlest things can turn you off. Oh, that person has bad breath, or I thought I caught them picking their nose. They smelt a little funny. Something was in their teeth. I don't know if their sense of humor is my style. Those things become deal breakers, right? But when you're in commitment mode, like marriage, when all other options are cut off, your immune system kicks in, and that stuff, you can get past it no problem, right? It doesn't matter. Like, your breast stinks, whatever. You no longer care about that. You simply adjust. And, you know, I get that this is the most unromantic view of marriage, but I'm convinced it cuts to the essence of love. Marriage is saying this, well, I'm stuck with you. So that being so, we've got two options here. I can be disgusted and miserable with you, or we can settle down to do the work of loving, being loved by another flawed human being. And this is precisely what our psychological immune system does when we're stuck. It works to find the silver lining. It works on our part to help us adjust, to work within the box we've been given. And this holds not just for marriages, it holds for friendships and churches as well. Get rid of options, and suddenly you find yourself adjusting, perhaps becoming more happy than you imagined. And you know, I at risk of being a bit offensive here, I've come to think that keeping our options open is like this cultural habit, this drug that we need to do away with, because we're forever keeping our options open in life. When it comes to relationships, our careers and vocation, shopping, church, faith, life. And I think the reality is this, at least in my mind, I believe consistently keeping our options open, our commitment to not committing, ends up producing self-indulgence, superficiality, emotional immaturity. And those things don't lead to happiness. But culturally, we're addicted to keeping our options open. It's making us anxious, perpetually dissatisfied with life. Another example, for instance, of what Gilbert calls impact bias. And what he means by that is we tend to exaggerate the outcome of our choices, which leads to even more forecasting errors. And so we're drawn to things that we believe are going to be incredible, but we come to realize over time, well, they're kind of mediocre, or we resist choosing something we think is going to be awful, when in fact, it's not nearly as bad as we might think. In fact, it might even make us happy. I don't know about you, I'm a bit of an introvert in this. I totally understand and relate to this. I tend to avoid social functions at all costs, if possible, because my forecasting system tells me it's going to be awkward and awful. And so, I mean, Kristen and I found ourselves in a bit of a weird sort of rhythm. I mean, I'm always protesting, hey, Brad, we're going out this night with so-and-so or to this party. I'm like, I don't want to go. It sounds awful to me. But more often than not, what I'm finding is this. When I'm forced to go, I find that I actually have a really good time. or a bare minimum, I'm like, you know what? That wasn't as bad as I thought it might be. I don't know. Perhaps you can relate to that a little bit. And if you can, I think you know what that means. You know, this idea that I have this idea of, oh, Friday night's going to be awful if I go out. I'd much rather sit at home alone. And then I end up going out and having a good time. What that means is this. I am not very good at forecasting how I am going to feel. I try to avoid leaving the house thinking being around lots of people is going to be awful. But I'm wrong. And so another reason happiness is so elusive, the reason we so often live in disappointment and frustration, is because we don't know what we want. And even when we think we do, we choose poorly. But let's go one step further before we close this off. Let's imagine that you know what you want, but you also want the right things. You want good things. You want healthy things. You've chosen and made decisions about your future happiness, and you've done it well. All good. But a third obstacle to happiness appears in front of you, and it's this. Why is it so hard to find happiness? Well, because we don't take the future seriously enough. And that's a problem, because when we give into short-term thinking, it becomes a barrier to happiness. And you know, we know this because most of the things we associate with happiness, like having a well-ordered life and schedule, or having a faithful relationship, having meaningful friendships, being healthy, devoting time to spiritual disciplines and mindfulness, community, most of these things are long-term projects. These things don't deliver short-term pleasure. I mean, most of us know this headwise. There are very few short-term gratifications that bring lasting satisfaction. And yet, we give into cravings and temptations that ultimately undo long-term thinking. I mean, this was the problem with the Hebrew people, right? Anytime a short-term hardship came up, they immediately caved. Sure, if we keep going, it might get better, but this is too hard now. Let's give in. Let's go back to Egypt. They're willing to sacrifice their future for immediate gratification. In fact, Richard Beck says this: almost every moral, spiritual, or happiness failure is driven by this dynamic, short-term gratification at the expense of long-term joy. And what Beck is saying is that this is true across the board, from our health to our morals to our spiritual lives to our general sense of happiness, even when we know what will make us happy. It's elusive because we end up sabotaging our own happiness by giving into short-term cravings. Let me give you two examples. Excuse me. First, we know scientifically demonstrated over and over again that belonging to a community, a faith community, is good for our sense of happiness. We know this. But here's the thing. Belonging in community does not provide short-term payoff. It can take years to feel a sense of belonging in community. Not only that, it takes work. You have to invest. People make asks of you. You have to make an effort. You have to show up. You have to contribute. And here's the thing, even though we know scientifically that one of the greatest correlating factors for happiness in life is being in community, even though we know that, community is worth the effort, we give into short-term gratification. And so we think, oh, the weather's bad. I'm not going to show up. I'm not going to head to Nexus. I'm tired. I'm going to sleep in. It's a lot of work to give financially. To make connections here, it's going to be awkward. Showing up to boomerang groups and events, really investing, stepping out, being vulnerable. All those things are hard work, and they don't often have short-term benefits. And so we sacrifice our long-term well-being for short-term gratification. Now, why do we do this? We don't take the future seriously enough. There's an old proverb that says a bird in hand is better than two in the bush, right? So what does that mean? Well, it's better to go with what you know you have than to necessarily go investing something that might be. Let me give you a little thought exercise to illustrate this. Let's say I offer you this choice. I will give you $100 or $200. Which do you want? Now, that seems obvious. In a straight up choice, $200 is more valuable than $100. So you would probably take the $200. But let me ask you this. What if the choice was this? I will give you $100 right now, or I will give you $200 a year from now. What do you do? Which one do you take? How many of you would take the $100 right away, right? Most of us. By the way, for those of you who actually think or say you're going to take the $200 a year from now, listen, you need to be on the next Preaching Guild because clearly you have your lives more put together and structured than the rest of us. But I digress. What research reveals is this. There are some outliers. Some of you listening might be thinking, oh, I'd take the $200 a year from now. But the vast majority of people in this situation, when given this option, they take the $100 right now. Why? Because the value of the money becomes relative in this scenario. People discount the future. And so $200 in the future is now perceived as being less valuable than $100 immediately. Time changes how much value we give something. The longer something is in the future, the less valuable it is. And that's why we give into short-term temptation. I mean, try this experiment again with different sort of time signatures. When exactly would you be willing to switch from choice A to choice B? So if choice A is to get $100 right now, choice B, which of these time signatures you can get $200 a year from today? No, maybe 6 months from today. What about 3 months from today? 1 month, 2 weeks, 1 week, 3 days, an hour, 12 hours, 1 hour, 30 minutes. At what point do you pick choice B? For me, as I thought about this little experiment, it's probably somewhere between the 1 month to 1 week area that I'd make the switch. Which is fascinating because I think that partially reveals to me something about myself, and that's this. For me, any happiness project or any self-improvement project probably needs some sort of payoff between a week and a month. But not a lot of those projects have a payoff that soon. And this is what fascinates me about humans. For us, time and value are related. Immediate payoffs are more valuable than distant ones. And what this does is so often it hijacks our ability to be happy. It is what makes happiness so elusive. Happiness and future thinking are related, and yet our makeup as humans, it sabotages us. And so here is where to close for this week. Even though I've got two more areas that we're going to explore next week before we get to some hope for the promised land of happiness, a silver lining. But for this week, why is happiness so elusive? I mean, who doesn't want to be happy? Who doesn't want to be content, to have some kind of positive countenance throughout our days? Of course, we all do. But if you're anything like me, happiness so often feels like it's like measurable in minutes. It's fleeting. And why? Well, at least three reasons. First, so often we don't know what we want. Second, even if we do, we tend to want the wrong kinds of things. Beyond that, we sabotage the things that will make us happy because third, we give into short-term temptation. We are present biased. We discount the future. We struggle to wait. And so we close this morning, I suppose, on a bit of a dour note. Happiness is elusive. And you know what? That's ordinary. It's just part of the human condition. But where to from here? Well, we're going to continue exploring this next week. But for this morning, as we go, some simple mindfulness questions. What do you want? Like, what do you really, really want? The second, who in your life is helping you resist wanting the wrong kinds of things? Who is speaking into your life? Who is it that you're letting into the decision-making process? And finally, where are you sabotaging yourself? Where is it that you often crave to temptation? Some reflection on those, at least some mindfulness around those questions, could be at least the beginning to finding a bit of a silver lining. Hope you enjoyed. Check out next week where we'll finish this up and provide a bit of a silver lining. Thanks for listening and take care.